Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Moeller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Moeller, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Moeller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Moeller Program. Why is it that so many of us would find comfort in thinking that our misbehavior is genetically determined? You know, all it takes is one report that spawns another dozen reports, and the next thing you know, all across the news media, the cable news programs, the radio programs, all the rest, are these new explanations that a genetic basis has been found for this behavior or that, usually misbehavior. But we're going to be looking today at this report that has come out of England suggesting that adultery on the part of women is genetically based. And it's going to be a good discussion about the genetic part. Why is it that we are looking for some kind of deterministic, biological, naturalistic explanation for our behavior? Why do we have such a hard time facing the fact that we do what is wrong because we want to? I think that's a big question. We're going to be looking at it in the second segment. First, a review of the news, big news out of Pennsylvania, where in eastern Pennsylvania, the United Methodists have held their second trial of an openly homosexual minister just this year, and a jury of 13 clergy persons in eastern Pennsylvania convicted a fellow pastor of violating church law by living in a lesbian relationship, and they ordered her defrocked. Yeah, you heard me right. The United Methodists held a trial. They found this openly homosexual minister guilty of violating the policies and the principles of the church, and they have ordered her defrocked. That's good news. Now, what's behind all this? Just remember that earlier this year, in the case of the Reverend Karen Damon in the Northwest, a jury found that she was openly homosexual, just as everyone knew, and they knew that that was in violation of the church standards, but they said the church standards were ambiguous. Well, the United Methodist Church met this summer in what is known as its General Conference, held every 4 years, and they decided to take out any room for ambiguity. They made it very unambiguous by an overwhelming margin. The United Methodist said, we know what we meant when we adopted these standards, and this is it. And I'm glad to say that in this first real test case, after the General Conference held this past June, this past summer, you have a very satisfying result here. In this case, the Reverend Irene Elizabeth Stroud is the associate pastor of Philadelphia's First United Methodist Church of Germantown. She has been living in an openly homosexual relationship. She came out in a sermon to her congregation. She announced that she is gay, and this led to this disciplinary action. And ladies and gentlemen, this is a reminder to us that if principles mean anything, they have to be enforced. And in this case, you have a denomination that is made up of people who, at the level of the pew, clearly understand what sex is, what marriage is, what gender is, and what ministry is. And I am thankful. I'm proud of our United Methodist friends, and I am thankful for them that their denomination took this step. We have to pray with them that it will stick, that it will be upheld at higher levels of jurisdiction. But this is a good piece of news, and as much as we've given attention to when churches have wimped out, caved in, and accommodated on these issues, I want to give a word of congratulations to a church that had the courage to do the right thing, to stand by biblical authority, and to stand by the tradition of the church, and to stand by their own stated principles. That's good news, any way you look at it. Well, what do you do if you are a pro-life Democrat? Well, you try to find the other one, I guess. You know, in all seriousness, you've got a situation in which they are vastly outnumbered. The Democratic Party has been so identified with the most pro-abortion wing of the abortion rights movement that it's inconceivable that we would really expect much movement there. As a matter of fact, there was not one pro-life speaker allowed anywhere near the platform of the Democratic National Convention this year. But now, pro-life Democrats are suggesting that they need to regain control of their party. Kristen Day of Democrats for Life of America said this, quote, I think the Republican Party really did a masterful job of claiming the pro-life issue, and we need to take it back. I think, she said, we really need to look at our strong pro-abortion stance and really come out and say that we want to truly make abortion rare. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if true, this would be great. If it were to happen, this would be a fantastic thing. Just imagine the situation in which we would have two parties doing their very best to contend for life, two parties doing their very best to gain the confidence and support of pro-life voters. That would be a great thing. But don't hold your breath, or I think you're going to turn blue on this one. Because the reality is that the Democratic Party is solidly in the control and indeed the coercive influence of people on the far left on this issue. So I have to say good luck to Democrats for life. But I'll believe it when I see it. That's the bottom line. Speaking of Democrats, what are we going to do with Henry Waxman, representative from California? He's up to his usual shenanigans. And in this case, what he's doing is taking aim at abstinence-based sex education programs. And it's pretty messy. Because what he is arguing here is that they are not scientifically credible. He quite quotes, cites, makes reference to a study, and guess who produced the study? Oh, as a matter of fact, when you look at it, he did. He commissioned his own staff to do a study to prove that abstinence-based sex education doesn't work. Listen to this, quote, "It is absolutely vital that the health education provided to America's youth be scientifically and medically accurate. The abstinence-only programs reviewed in this report fail to meet this standard. Something is seriously wrong when federal tax dollars are being used to mislead kids about basic health facts," end quote. Now, first of all, if you just take his words, who in the world is going to disagree with that? We want sex education to be scientifically correct, and we would not want it to have scientific errors, be wrong about basic health facts. What is he upset about? He's upset about the fact that these abstinence-based programs aren't really big on endorsing condom use. Now, let's think about this for just a moment. If you are practicing abstinence, you don't need condoms. If you need condoms, you're not practicing abstinence. So that would just appear to be in the logic of the whole thing, but that's a logic that evidently escapes this member of Congress. But then he goes at the very fact that this group of curricula, this group of sex education programs actually suggests that condoms don't always work. And guess what? Condoms don't always work. But facts are facts, and they are resistant things. But I want to tell you what really made me angry in this report. I printed out the entire report on page 15, and it's available at Congressman Waxman's website. He says this, "Although religious and moral codes offer different answers to the question of when life begins, some abstinence-only curricula present specific religious views on this question as scientific fact. One curriculum teaches, quote, conception, also known as fertilization, occurs when one sperm unites with one egg in the upper third of the fallopian tube. This is when life begins, end quote. Now, this report suggests that that's not necessarily when life begins. Well, Mr. Waxman, that's when life begins. And actually, that is not a controversial fact. This report would have a lot more credibility if it had been written by scientists rather than by staff members on congressional staff, in this case, Representative Waxman's staff. But I tell you what is really aggravating is that you have something like what we have right here in my hands where the New York Times runs a story on this, and the lead sentence is this, "Some federally financed sex education programs that teach an abstinence-only approach have factual errors and are ineffective, a congressional report says." Well, that phrase, a congressional report, lends more credibility to this than it deserves. Ladies and gentlemen, yesterday we introduced a new feature that we'll be going back to again and again on the Albert Mueller program as Christmas approaches. That is the Grinch Report. We were telling you about what has been going on as the Grinch and his spirit have been very much at work. But today we're going to introduce something else, and I'm afraid it will be more occasional, more rare, and that is the Grinch Relents Report. Well, there you hear the familiar refrain of the good news when the Grinch relents. And there is good news in that Mervyn's Department Stores has changed its decision to bar the Salvation Army from its stores. Yesterday, we looked at the fact that the Target Stores company has nationwide banned the Salvation Army, saying that to allow one group and not others will be discriminatory. It's clear there's something more going on there. But the Mervyn's Department Store now has relented, says they're going to let the Salvation Army back, and said this, "We didn't fully realize the implications this, that is, the banning of the Salvation Army, would have. They were facing the reality of a boycott, massive customer complaints, and that is good news." Also yesterday, we were looking at Denver, where in their annual Christmas lights parade, a church was being forbidden to have an explicitly Christian message, even though the Buddhists were able to have some kind of special anti-evil spirit dance. And there was another float celebrating the spirits of dead homosexual Native Americans. Folks, truth really is stranger than fiction. You can't make this up. But the good news here in the Grinch Relents Report is that Denver's mayor has finally found a line in the sand he will not cross. He has ordered that the words Merry Christmas still be allowed in the holiday display at the city and county building in Denver, Colorado. Merry Christmas. Well, the Grinch didn't win this one. But what does it tell you about America when the fact that the mayor says Merry Christmas stays is national news? We're living in a confused time, and this is where we're going to try to bring some clarity out of the confusion. We talk about what matters, and frankly, an explanation for sin and misbehavior really matters. Some say it's in the genes. I want to know what you say. Get ready to call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll be right back for a conversation about what really matters. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Today we're talking about why we do what we do and why it is that we would like to be able to be told that we do it because of the genes. We do it because of our DNA. We do it because of some materialistic, naturalistic, deterministic reason that we don't have any control over. I'll tell you why. I think the bottom line is it relieves us of responsibility. If we do what we are supposedly genetically programmed to do, then we couldn't do anything else and we can't be held responsible for our misdeeds. Of course, the fact that this destroys the very basis of morality is incidental to those who are trying to push their moral relativism on us. And what we have right now is this week, this report that comes out of London suggesting that adultery on the part of females is genetically based. In this case, this is a report that is out suggesting, and this comes from St. Thomas's Hospital in central London, suggesting that female infidelity is 38% due to a woman's genes. Yeah, you heard that right, 38%. Now, I guess she's still responsible for the other, 62%? But at least in terms of 38%, it's not there. Not only that, you talk about statistics, just listen to this. You're talking about a 38% factor in a moral equation that is 40% heritable. You want to write that down and take notes? Of course, it's nonsense. Don't even think about it. What is going on here? Tim Spector is a professor. He's the author, by the way, of the book Your Genes Unzipped. That's G-E-N-E-S, in case you didn't catch on. Your Genes Unzipped, How Your Genetic Inheritance Shapes Your Life. He says this, this study justifies additional genetic and molecular research on human sexual behavior. What's he really up to? He's trying to find a way to say that sexual misbehavior isn't really immoral. It's natural. Folks, this isn't really a new argument. I have here in my hands a book entitled The Myth of Monogamy, Fidelity, and Infidelity in Animals and People. It's by David Bayrash and Judith Eve Lipton. This came out just a couple of years ago, and in this book, they, using the same kind of logic, go through the animal world and say, hey, apes are not monogamous. Chimpanzees are not monogamous. Dogs and cats are not monogamous. And since those animals aren't monogamous, we must not have been meant to be monogamous either. The same kind of study came out just recently. Of course, we've been looking at the Hamer study from time to time, trying to argue for a genetic basis of homosexuality. And then, of course, Dean Hamer came out with his book, The God Gene, we talked about just a matter of weeks ago. He and his colleague Peter Copeland have another book entitled Living with Our Genes. Here's the subtitle of the book. Listen to this. The groundbreaking book about the science of personality, behavior, and genetic destiny. I tell you, the word science there is just a lie. And this isn't really about science. It's about moral myth-making. That's what they're up to. It's a new myth they're spawning that we are genetically programmed in terms of morality. So whatever we do, we're doing it just like as one animal among other animals. It's just normal because we do it. It's in the genes. We're not responsible. And furthermore, what this really says is marriage is artificial. Monogamy is repressive. If you want to be healthy, you won't get married and stay monogamous, and you certainly wouldn't stay pure and abstinent until marriage. Instead, you just give yourself to whatever sexual activity you want. And by the way, some of this stuff is just downright grotesque. You have some of these scientists who are making arguments that basically we need to share the genetic pool. We need more diversity. Monogamy leads to an insufficient genetic diversity. And besides that, we need more, and this is the really insidious part of the argument, some are saying we need more emotional fulfillment than can come from monogamy. I can't think of anything more perverse than this kind of moral myth-making. Because I got to tell you, human beings really don't need to be encouraged to sin. Have you noticed that? Human beings really do not need any encouragement. There's enough adultery going on out there, regrettably and tragically so, without someone coming along to say, hey, it's just natural. It's indeed normal. It's monogamy that's the weird thing. Tell me what you think about this. Why is it that we want to be told it's in the genes? And tell me if you are ready to accept that argument. The number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We've got calls coming in. I want to hear what you think about this, because this is where the water hits the wheel in terms of the moral equation. Out there all the time are persons contemplating doing the wrong thing. They're tempted by one form of sexual sin or another. They're tempted to steal. They're tempted to cheat on their income tax. They're tempted towards alcohol abuse. They're tempted towards illegal drug use. They're tempted towards all kinds of things. And just think of what it means when we tell them, hey, it's probably in your genes anyway. If you have this desire, it's just probably normal for you. And furthermore, there may be a good thing behind this in terms of an evolutionary worldview anyway. And there's the worldview dimension. Because if we are just one animal among other animals, one species among other species, then our morality is simply false, because the animal morality is the one we should follow. Of course, the Christian worldview is directly antithetical to that. What we read in Scripture is that we are not merely one species among other species, but rather that we are human beings made in the image of God, the only species with a moral conscience, a moral capacity, and the ability to know and to relate to God directly. And we are the only species addressed by God with His word, with His command, and with His law. Tell me what you think. 877-893-8255 in Cleveland, Ohio. There's Dave ready to say something. Dave, join the conversation.
Oh, hi, Dr. Moeller. Boy, it just seems like all these issues tie in. Every day there's something new that the anti-God or the liberal movement comes up with. And it seems like blaming genetics for behavior seems to be the trend, and I guess it makes it makes the people who partake in this type of behavior feel that they're not responsible, they're not accountable, and it I guess it just relieves their conscience a little bit, or at least that's what they're trying to do, it appears.
Yeah. Dave, we got a weak connection, but yet a strong point, and I appreciate that. Yeah, when it comes down to guilt, by the way, have you noticed how the new psychological construct, the new approach is that you should just get over the guilt? You know, one of the questions is why we feel guilt and shame in the first place. According to the Bible, God gave us a conscience in order that it would be a teacher, it would be an instructor, it would be like a little prosecuting attorney to come to us and say, hey, you did something wrong. That's an important capacity. And sometimes we feel guilt because we are, guilty. Sometimes we are feeling shame because we did something shameful. But according to this new deterministic genetic worldview, this new moral myth, I'm calling it, there's really nothing to be guilty or ashamed of. It's you should never feel that way. Let's go to Amy calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Amy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Moeller. Thanks for taking my call. Correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't the Bible say that man is to rule over the animals?
Amy,
like the animals?
No, you got that exactly right. The Bible very clearly does say that. And tie that morally here. What does that, you're absolutely right, but what does that mean related to how we're supposed to be morally different than, say, the rest of the animal species?
Well, they do a lot of things that we would never think of doing. I mean, they eat things that we wouldn't eat. Therefore, should we eat their food and not have steak for dinner? And, I mean, and the Bible is completely clear on the relationship. I mean, a husband and a wife is the highest earthly relationship that we can possibly have.
Amy, you're talking common sense there. You know, animals do a lot of things that we wouldn't do, including cannibalism. In an awful lot of species, you have adults that will eat their own young. They do an awful lot of things we wouldn't do. They run in packs. They're, at least many of them, are carnivores. And even those that aren't, you notice they don't feel any guilt when they eat. They don't feel any guilt when they do what's wrong. They do not have a moral conscience. Well, Amy's a clear-headed one here, but what about these moral myth-makers? What are they really up to? You know, I think this is an insidious assault upon personal responsibility, upon the very idea that we do what's wrong because we want to do it. But, you know, I think that's what the Bible tells us. We do what's wrong because we decide to. Join the conversation by calling 877-893-8255. The issue is whether or not our behavior is in the genes. It's your turn to talk. I'm Albert Mohler.
Listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
You know, I have to say that I would have found this argument very helpful as a kid. You know, where was this when I needed it? Where was it when I was caught doing the wrong thing? I can just see making the case to my dad. Hey, Dad, it was in the genes. This disobedience thing, A, is genetically based, or at least 38%. So at best, I'm only like 62% responsible. And riding the bike where I wasn't supposed to ride it, telling a lie, you know, disobeying mom, all those things, that is just a part of it's a spiraling out evolutionary behavior pattern, Dad. And you see, if you understand it, you'll understand that you really shouldn't be punishing me for this. It's just a part of evolution. It's just a genetic thing. And by the way, I'm your genetic offspring, so the acorn probably didn't fall too far from the oak here, huh, Dad? I don't think I would have gotten very far with that. And by the way, I don't think anyone's going to get very far with this in a court of law. I mean, I don't think anyone that's going to be charged with murder is going to be able to get up and be very plausible before a jury and say, hey, I have a murder gene, or an embezzlement gene, or a dishonesty, a perjury gene. You know, we as Christians really do have an explanation for this. It's called sin. It's called total depravity. It is called Genesis 3 that makes very clear that once human beings sinned, sin corrupted every part of our constitution, every part of our being, every part of our body, mind, soul, and spirit. It's all corrupted. And, of course, our genetic heritage has been corrupted by sin. But what nonsense to say that we can just track this all down to some kind of genetic basis. The lead researcher in this case, Tim Spector, says that his new research lends support to evolutionary psychologist theories on the origins of human behavior. And see, that's what I think is behind this, is pushing the evolutionary morality and the evolutionary worldview. I want to know what you think. The number 877-893-8255. Let's go to Douglas in Cleveland, Ohio. Douglas, welcome to the program.
How are you doing, Dr. Mohler?
Doing great. Go right ahead.
Make this statement really quick and get out of your way. I'm a behavioral biologist. I want to know what kind of a foundation this gentleman bases his argument on when one of God's most mighty creatures is born monogamous. The American bald eagle mates for life. Once its mate dies, male or female, it chooses no other, and it goes on for life that way. And I thank you for giving me the time.
Hey, Douglas, listen, don't hang up. You can hang with me here for just a minute. You are a behavioral biologist?
Yes.
Okay, well, listen, I'm glad you called, because they've got an answer to you, and I want to give you a chance to refute it. In this book I have here in my hands, The Myth of Monogamy, Fidelity and Infidelity in Animals and People, that's by David P. Bayrash and Judith Eve Lipton, and that's one of the books cited in this area. I need you to respond. I really need you on this, Doug, because what they say is that what is apparent monogamy in the animal world isn't real monogamy, because it's just that the male is guarding the female and he's got too little time to go mate with someone else. Can you help me with that?
Too little time?
Yeah, I'm just reading from the book here. They say there's just not enough time.
I mean, if you wanted to go basically on it, the male species of our lower animal basically is the hunter-gatherer situation with certain... I'm a bird biologist, basically.
And you're going to tell us that eagles really are monogamous, right?
They are totally monogamous. They mate for life. They mate totally for life. That is why it took us such a hard time to repopulate them in Massachusetts and Maine.
Douglas, thank you for this call. Common sense with scientific expertise from a behavioral biologist. You can't buy that, guys. And, folks, I really do appreciate that call. You know, Douglas says the eagles are monogamous. And by the way, even those who are writing this book on the myth of monogamy have to concede that a number of other animals appear to be monogamous. But let's just think for a minute. What would be the sociological result of denormalizing monogamy among human beings? What would we be left with? Well, for one thing, we wouldn't know who belongs to whom. I mean, just take morality out of it for a moment. Let's just think about it in terms of a census report or an income tax report. What are you going to say? You know, monogamy is God's plan for us, not merely because he wanted to restrict us to one mating pair, that's the way the evolutionists would talk, but because he wants us to know the emotional satisfaction that comes from receiving his good gift of sex and marriage just as he intended it for us. And monogamy is not some kind of repressive institution. It is indeed the arena of purity and of health and of holiness within which human beings can relate to each other safely, healthfully, productively, joyously, fulfillingly. It's not a prison we're caught in. It's a covenant we enter willingly, and the rewards are far beyond what I guarantee you any evolutionary theorist can come up with. Is it in the genes or not? There's still time for you to call. I'd love to hear from someone who thinks it is, who thinks that the genes really do determine our behavior. Give me a call. We'll get you on the air. The number 877-893-8255. This is the Albert Mueller Program. You know, folks, one of the big issues here is just what kind of credence or credibility we see in this kind of scientific report that gets broadcast all over the media. CNN, Fox News, the BBC, they were all carrying this. A lot of newspapers carried this as well. And you saw interesting headlines. That's another factor in all of this. How does this get presented? There were some headlines that came out and said it's in the genes. Women who commit adultery aren't responsible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, when you actually look at these scientific reports, you often see how thin they are, and in fact, how unscientific a lot of this supposed science is. This is moral myth-making, and they're getting away with it because the secular media loves this. And I think there are a lot of people who are involved in these things who would love to be told it's just in the genes as well. We're going to go to Hervik from Louisville, Kentucky. Hervik, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Mueller. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to affirm my agreement with your sentiments. I think what we have here, people have natural affections and they want to sin, but then they go out and seek out an authority figure or opinion leader, whoever that may be, who okays their behavior, and then this becomes the confirmatory bias, and they use it as a license for their rebellious lifestyle. And I think that's exactly what's happening here. And this is particularly true, I think, of American culture, because they're so easily influenced and impressionable.
Hervik, I think you're really onto something there. And you know, what immediately comes to my mind is what the Apostle Paul said to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 4, where in writing to his young apprentice in ministry, the Apostle Paul said that people will look for preachers who will tell them what they want to hear. And he spoke of it in terms of itching ears. He said they'll heap up for themselves false teachers who will tell them what they want to hear. And I think that's true here. I think that's why humanistic psychology has such a large following. It's because it tells us, hey, you're actually okay. Hey, the problem's not in you. It's in your environment. Or it's not your fault. It was your parents' fault because your parents, they either nursed you too long or too little or spanked you too little or too much or, you know, whatever. It's just it's not your fault. And it was a repressive educational system you were forced into. It's sick stuff. And then, of course, you have the whole case of Alfred Kinsey. We've talked about that, especially with the release of that movie in which he came up with all these statistical reports in order to say, hey, we can establish a scientific sexual morality, which ended up being a non-scientific immorality. But there you have it. He becomes the guru. He becomes the authority figure, just like Hervik is talking about here. People say, well, Kinsey said it's normal. Well, when you consider how perversely abnormal Alfred Kinsey was, you understand he was in no position to know what normal was. But even if he did the right science in terms of getting it down into the right statistical numbers, that still doesn't establish what's right. I mean, the reality is that the majority of people in the world will at one point or another lie. That doesn't make lying normative. That doesn't make lying moral. Just because everyone does it, or at least has done it at some time, or is tempted to do it. You ever thought about the fact that we all have a lying orientation? In that we are at least tempted not to tell the truth. But you know, again, if I tried that with my parents, that I told a lie, but it was in the genes, I'm afraid it would have been a different set of genes that got the answer for that one. And if in a court of law, a guy accused of perjury says, hey, it's just in the genes, I don't think he's going to get that very far either. Let's go to Sharon, calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Sharon, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I sit here and listen to all of these people, and their points are extremely well. As far as I was raised, you marry someone, you stay with someone. That's what the vows in the church are, and death do us part. However, there is a point in the Bible that makes it known that if your spouse is not faithful to you, that gives you grounds for divorce. However, I do believe that when I'm born, my eyes are green and my hair is red because of the genes from my parents. However, my mother does not decide whether or not I'm going to cheat when I am older. That's like saying my mother stole and killed and lied, so because she did it, I'm going to do it, and that makes it right. And that does not make it right. You are responsible for you, and to lie and say that's in your genes, that's preposterous. I've never heard such a foul thing from a person.
Well, Sharon, God bless you. I like the preposterous part because I think that's exactly what it is. And I also love the way you say, you know, you can't blame your mom for what you did. You know, we'd all like to be able to do that. Sure, I did what I did because of the genes I got from mom and dad. That's just who I am. And you put that genetic train together with that genetic train, and the next thing you know, you've got a locomotive headed right down the behavioral highway. And my misbehavior is not my fault. It's somebody else's fault. And by the way, this whole nurture versus nature debate really doesn't get you anywhere because both of them are trying to say we're not responsible. One side's trying to say, hey, it's in the genetic background, the genetic makeup of the human being. The other's trying to say it's just in the experiences we have, the nurture. Have you ever noticed the fact that there are people who have had horrible experiences who are highly moral, highly morally motivated people? You know, they were raised by dishonest parents, but they're honest. They were raised by people who were violent, but they're nonviolent. You know, that's a counter evidence in and of itself. Let's go quickly to Rhonda calling from Knoxville, Tennessee. Rhonda, welcome.
Hi, I was just going to make a statement about what you were saying about the legalities, you know, that people, they won't stand up in a court of law. Well, in New York, they had a class action suit about a vagrant, a guy doing drugs, who was on the transit system. He was beating a cancer patient on his way to therapy, and the transit system, the New York transit system, shot him. Well, they shot him and paralyzed him from the waist down. He won a $3 million settlement. The cancer patient guy died. Now, where is the justice in that?
Well, there isn't any. And, Rhonda, just taking your story as you tell it here, is another example of what happens when you allow people to make the kind of argument that they're not responsible for their behavior, whether it's because nurture, nature, genes, whatever. It's a very dangerous argument. Finally, we're going to go quickly to Chris calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Mueller. You know, you can't discount genetics all the way, though. I mean, certainly genetics play a role. Whether or not that gets us off in a court of law really has nothing to bear on whether or not genetics truly have, from a scientific perspective, an influence on behavior. It doesn't get you off of if you do something bad in society. Society still has to take an action to prevent you from harming society. But that doesn't really speak to the truth of whether or not genetic theories are true or false.
Well, Chris, let me ask you a question. First of all, this scientific data is not very scientific, but we just have a few seconds. How much do you think genes do play a role?
I don't know the breadth to which they play a role, but to say that they play no role is to totally discount something which does have some scientific validity. It's not as black and white as I think you want to make it appear.
All right. Well, I appreciate your comment, and you might be surprised by something I have to say when we come back. I'll be right back after this one. Some final reflections on genes and morality and how all this comes together. What does it have to do with human responsibility, human dignity, and human nature? How does sin play into this? Or can we even talk about sin anymore? I'll be back with some final reflections. We'll try to tie all this up. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Gentlemen, there's some people who don't think that you can really talk about deep subjects on the radio. I think we've just proved that today. This is a pretty deep subject. It's a big one because it doesn't get any bigger than talking about who we are as human beings and why we do what we do and whether or not we can blame it on the genes. Just before we went into the break, we had a caller, Chris, very articulate, saying that we can't discount the genetic basis altogether. And he challenged us on that. And by the way, I think he's right. In other words, I would not discount that altogether. I am going to lampoon and indeed to put my fiercest guns, intellectually speaking, over against these ridiculous claims made in the media and by some researchers who generally are trying to sell their books as well as their worldview. In claiming, I mean, the most ridiculous part of this is arguing that you've got a 38% genetic factor in a decision for a woman to commit adultery. That's just absolutely ridiculous. You can't even really call that science. But let's assume for a minute that sin really does affect every part of our Constitution. Then it, of course, affects our genetic heritage. It affects our genetic structure. And, you know, there are pieces of evidence to which we can point showing that, for instance, a tendency towards dependence upon alcohol or alcohol addiction can be somewhat genetically identified. And there are others working on issues of violence and all the rest. But as much as we need to understand that, because we want to understand the human being in terms of a biophysiological reality, we understand that our moral dimension isn't just answered by that. It can't be. Because we're not just who we are in terms of chemical reactions, genetic material, and all the rest. We are who we are because we are also decision-making creatures. We are moral creatures made in God's image who are making decisions about what we are going to do. And the bottom line is, if we did know, for instance, that we had a genetic predisposition to violence, we'd want to correct that. We'd want to be very watchful about that. If we had a genetic predisposition to alcoholism, we'd want to know that ahead of time in order to stay completely away from alcohol and not risk any danger of that at all. If there was a genetic predisposition to this or to that, we would want to know it because if it is a wrongful, a sinful, an immoral behavior, we would want to put defense mechanisms in our life so that we would be less likely to do those things. I mean, after all, if it's a genetic illness, then let's seek a cure. But the reality is that the moral myth-making we're talking about here is on the part of those who say, if it's in the genes, just do it. Feel no guilt, feel no shame. It's just natural. And there really are people making these arguments. And, of course, on the issue of homosexuality, routinely, periodically, you will see reports saying that they found this genetic basis or another, and, of course, that they have not panned out. Not one of them has panned out scientifically. We'll watch. We'll wait. We'll read carefully, critically, and clearly. And I'll be back next time to report on what they're saying about genes and morality. Next week, we've got a lot of important issues to discuss. I'll look forward to seeing you then. God bless you. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Mohler's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.